WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The beauty of Chet Baker's singing and trumpet playing and the mystique of cool that surrounded him is contrasted to his troubled life, drug addiction, and wrecked relationships in the new book Deep in a Dream, The Long Night of Chet Baker. My guest is the author, James Gavin. Gavin is also the author of an earlier book called Intimate Nights, The Golden Age of New York Cabarets. Chet Baker was born in 1929 in Oklahoma, became part of the West Coast jazz scene, and started recording in the 1950s. He died in 1988 under mysterious circumstances. He fell from his third-floor hotel room in Amsterdam. The death was ruled either a suicide or a drug-induced accident. The new Chet Baker biography inspired a companion CD, also called Deep in a Dream, which includes this 1954 recording of the song Baker is most associated with, My Funny Valentine.
My funny valentine, sweet comic valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart? But don't change your hair for me.
That's Chet Baker. My guest is James Gavin, author of a new biography of Baker. James Gavin, welcome to Fresh Air.
So happy to be here, Terry.
What does Chet Baker mean to you as a listener?
Well, when I think of a recording like My Funny Valentine, which we just heard, I was so captured when I first heard that recording years ago by the combination of two things that don't seem to fit logically together. One is this soft, vulnerable, seemingly very sensitive tone that he had as a singer and as a trumpet player, and also this complete detachment, this almost numbness that he sang with. In other words, the delivery is completely emotionless. The tone is very winsome and tender and fragile. And that is one of the big paradoxes of Chet Baker. It's one of the things that always fascinated me about him.
Baker started performing locally at about the age of 12. You say his mother taught him standards. Years later, he confided to the pianist Jimmy Rolls that some of the children laughed at him when he sang, calling him a sissy and saying that he sounded like a girl. What impact did that have on him?
Well, you know the way Chet Baker sang when he was mature, when he was in his 20s, so you can imagine how he must have sounded before his voice changed. And I think that being called a sissy and compared to a girl, it's painful enough for a man to hear that in the times we're living in now. But back then, in the early 40s, that's when that would have been. That was devastating because at that time, the sex roles were extremely defined. If you stepped out of being a real man or a real woman, then you were in big trouble. And that's one of the big problems that Chet Baker had after he became famous, because he was not taken seriously by a lot of people as a result of that. I think it's one of the many things in his life that created incredible anger in him. And anger is one of the things that he stifled in the years when he became known as a so-called cool trumpeter and singer.
Well, after Chet Baker started singing, and kids were calling him a sissy. His father was apparently a little worried about that, too. You say his father brought him a trombone because he hoped it would be a more manly way of making music. So how did Baker end up with a trumpet after his father presented him with a trombone?
Chet was not that tall. I think as a grown man, he was about 5'9". And when he was not fully grown and a boy, you know, if you extend a trombone all the way, it's enormous and it's also heavy. And he said that he simply couldn't handle carrying it and manipulating it. So a trumpet is much smaller. And his father, so the story goes, reluctantly went out and exchanged the trombone for a trumpet. And that's what Chet Baker played for most of the rest of his life.
Baker started getting into trouble as a teenager. His mother, you say, signed him into the army a few weeks before he reached legal age. He ended up playing in an army dance band. Do you think that that helped him develop musically?
I think that playing in an army dance band convinced him that he really had no particular interest in learning music by the books. And that's where he decided the way he really wanted to play. He was not interested in learning theory or studying technique. Part of it was laziness, but part of it, I guess, was the instinct of knowing that that's not the message that he wanted to communicate. He was fond of saying that most trumpet players are expected to sound virtuoso and bravura and to play high, fast, and loud. And these aren't things that he was, A, particularly adept at or, B, that interested in, because he was a very lyrical player. He played in a linear way. And that is one of the reasons, I think, why the melodicism of his playing has such a direct appeal. You don't have to be a musicologist or a jazz aficionado particularly to get his message, because the sound is sweet and the lines are lyrical and they're graceful and they're beautifully formed and they fall so beautifully upon the ear that it's a pleasure to listen to him no matter what kind of music you may like.
How did Baker start playing with baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan? They had a very famous group in the 1950s. They started playing together in 52.
Jerry Mulligan had come to Los Angeles from New York in the early 50s because his career had hit a dead end in New York. He was a heroin addict. Things were not going so well. And he went to L.A. to have a fresh start. And he came upon the idea gradually of creating something revolutionary at the time, which was a quartet that had no piano. It had two horns. As he conceived it, it would have two horns, bass, and drums. And therefore, he would be much harmonically freer with the other horn player to do what he wanted to do. Because a pianist really dominates the harmony of music. And Jerry Mulligan apparently didn't have a lot of respect for most of the pianists that were around at that time, because he felt that they sort of hogged the spotlight. And he needed another horn player, and he and Chet met at a sort of a jam session. And Chet Baker clicked with him immediately. They were personal rivals and professionally seemed to be infatuated with the way they played together.
What kind of sound did they create together, the kind of counterpart melodies that they would play with each other?
These were two very melodic players. They had that much in common because although Jerry Mulligan was musically virtuosic and was already known as a great arranger who had contributed to the Miles Davis Birth of the Cool recordings, which, as you well know, were historic in modern jazz, but Jerry Mulligan also loved a tune, as did Chet Baker. And when they got together on stage, they were able to put their egos aside and completely wrap their lines around one another. They had a rare rapport. It's unusual that you'll put two jazz horn players together who will not duel, who will not try to top one another, and who will not try to show the audience, you know, who's stronger, who's more manly, who can make a louder sound. What they were making was the sound of cool because, again, everything stayed nice and relaxed. It had a kind of swagger to it. And it was a collection of soft melodic sounds that swung lightly. It was not aggressive East Coast type jazz at all. It was very laid back and, in my opinion, very California of the day.
Why don't we hear a track that you've included on your companion CD, Deep in a Dream? And this is Aren't You Glad You're You, the Burk Van Usen song. And it's recorded in 1952, the year that Baker and Mulligan started playing together. Jerry Mulligan and Chet Baker, Aren't You Glad You're You, from the CD Deep in a Dream, which is a companion CD to the book Deep in a Dream, a new biography of Chet Baker. My guest is the author, James Gavin. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Gavin, author of a new biography of the late trumpet player and singer Chet Baker. How did Chet Baker start singing on record and in performances? He sang as a boy. And then, but when he started his recording career, he was known as a trumpeter. It wasn't until a little later that he actually started singing.
William Claxton tells the story of a party given at the Music Salon in the home of the legendary Doris Duke, Falcon Lair. And Doris Duke at that time had a young lover named Joe Castro, who was a jazz pianist who worked at the Macambo, I believe, in Los Angeles. And Joe Castro loved jazz, of course, loved the visiting jazz musicians who came to town. And he had a little musicale in his salon one night that was attended by a handful of very hip jazz musicians and singers. One of them was one of my very favorite singers, June Christie. And Bill tells the story of Chet and June sitting at the piano together and singing Cole Porter's song Every Time We Say Goodbye and spellbinding the crowd. As Bill tells it, it was a magical moment, and everybody encouraged Chet Baker to sing. Now, Chet Baker, as you said, was known primarily as a trumpet player at that time. The band, the entire trio that he worked with at that time, they were against it. They thought that his singing was basically ridiculous. But Chet was stubborn enough to persist, and now I think it's safe to say that even more people love him as a singer than as a trumpet player.
Well, on the companion CD to your book, Deep in a Dream, you have two a cappella Chet Baker tracks that are, well, why don't you explain where these tracks are from?
A few years ago, a producer and arranger and band leader, a wonderfully talented man named Bob Belden, was working on a reissue of the big commercial Chet Baker album of that period of the 50s, which was called Chet Baker with Strings on Columbia Records. This was a big deal for Chet Baker. No singing, just trumpet playing with arrangers like Marty Paich and Johnny Mandel, an expensive, splashy album. And it seems that at the end of one of those sessions, which took place in late 53, early 54, Chet Baker just went to the microphone and for fun sang one chorus all the way through of Spring Is Here and Blue Room, which are two Rodgers and Hart songs. And these were never released. They were never intended to be released. And there's a spooky quality to them. The silence is striking because he sings them without any accompaniment at all, and his pitch is actually pretty good on these two tracks. And yet I heard them, and I was so struck by this tenderness and sweetness in the sound, but an emotional deadness as he's singing, on one hand, Spring Is Here, a heartbreaking song about being alone, and on the other hand, Blue Room, which is an idyllic song about a sort of a honeymoon between two people. He's singing them very tenderly, and yet I feel as if he's not even there as he's singing them. There's a very spooky quality about that that fascinates me.
Well, I love these tracks. I'm so glad you were able to bring them out on your CD. Why don't we hear Blue Room? This is an outtake from a 1953 session.
We'll have a blue room, a new room for two rooms, where every day's a holiday, because you're married to me. Not like a ballroom, a small room, a hall room, where I can smoke my pipe away with your wee head upon my knee. We will thrive on, keep alive on, just nothing but kisses with Mr. and Mrs. on little blue chairs. You sew your trousseau and Robinson Crusoe is not so far from worldly cares as our blue room far away upstairs.
That's Chet Baker singing a cappella and an outtake from a 1953 recording session. My guest, James Gavin, is the author of a new biography of Chet Baker called Deep in a Dream. The track that we just heard is from a companion CD. Listening to that, I think, who wouldn't have romantic fantasies about Chet Baker, listening to him sing that way? On the other hand, pianist Hal Galper said about him, Chet was an absolute realist. He didn't have a romantic bone in his body or a naive one. He played all the games. He was a pro. What kind of games is Galper talking about?
The games he's talking about date from later on, when Chet Baker became a serious heroin addict. And that really happened in about 1956. And at the time that Hal was working with him, that was the mid-60s. Hal was the pianist in a trio that was touring with Chet Baker throughout the United States. And this was a time when Chet had been in Europe for several years, had been in jail in Italy on a serious drug charge for over a year, had basically gotten himself thrown out of a number of European countries, and came back to America in 1964 and found that he wasn't particularly wanted there either. And he, in fact, could not get a cabaret license, which is something that you need in order to work in a Manhattan jazz club. His drug infractions made it impossible for him to get this license. And so off they went on the road, playing whatever gigs out of town that they could play. And by this time, Chet Baker was so addicted to heroin that, as with any heroin addict, you have to learn how to play all of those games simply to stay high. It becomes, as Anita O'Day once said, hour to hour. That is what your need is.
To get enough money to get the drugs.
To get enough money to get the drugs, and also, where do you find the drugs if you're in, you know, Dubuque on the road, sitting around at a Howard Johnson's, and it's 3 a.m. and you need your stuff. So this becomes a full-time occupation that he had to handle in addition to simply playing the music.
You also quote Lori Pepper, the widow of the saxophonist Art Pepper, as saying that Chet Baker was a career police informant.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that information come from?
It came from quite a few people, as a matter of fact. If you look at the police records of Chet Baker in the 60s, quite interesting, because he got arrested and arrested and arrested, and he was not getting thrown into jail most of the time, maybe for a night or two, but he kept getting himself out of it, and I wondered how. And when I started doing my research and asking people who knew him at the time, it became pretty clear that he did what a lot of people that are picked up for crimes like that will do. If you inform on somebody, they'll show you some leniency. And Art Pepper had grown to hate Chet Baker because men like that have a certain code of ethics, and that is that you do not rat on people. This is standard prison ethics. And Chet Baker was known to rat on a lot of people, and Art Pepper hated him for it.
My guest is James Gavin, author of a new biography of Chet Baker called Deep in a Dream. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Gavin, the author of Deep in a Dream, a new biography of the late trumpeter and singer Chet Baker. Baker died in 1988, falling from his third-floor hotel room in Amsterdam. His death is still somewhat of a mystery. Why don't you describe what is known about his death in 1988?
You know, all the theories that have circulated through the years about how Chet Baker died are perfectly in keeping with the tendency to romanticize him. And the theory that was most popular is that he was murdered because he hadn't paid his drug dealer or he'd had some kind of scuffle with a drug dealer. And I was not in the room that night, so I can't say with 100% certainty that that didn't happen. What I can say is that I looked through the police report, which was an extremely detailed one, page by page, with the officer who handled the investigation, and there was no evidence whatsoever of a struggle. The door was locked from inside, so there was no hint that anybody had been there with him. But there is abundant evidence that Chet Baker wanted to die because he told so many people that he did. And it was sort of a passive-aggressive suicide, in my opinion, because Chet knew enough by this time to know that if he were high on this dastardly combination of drugs that he used, and if he were alone, something terrible might happen. And something terrible did happen. He died.
Well, James Gavin, thank you very much for talking with us.
My great pleasure, Terry.
And James Gavin is the author of the new book, Deep in a Dream, The Long Night of Chet Baker. There's also a companion CD with some of his classic recordings on it and a few outtakes as well. We're going to close this interview with a recording that he made near the end of his life, and this is from the soundtrack to the documentary about him, Let's Get Lost. This is the Elvis Costello song, Almost Blue. James Gavin, do you want to say anything about this song, this recording?
About Almost Blue. From the Let's Get Lost soundtrack?
Yeah.
Sure, I can. Elvis Costello adores Chet Baker and always has. And in Elvis Costello's earlier years, he heard a very haunting version of The Thrill Is Gone from one of Chet Baker's early Pacific Jazz recordings. And it occurred to him at one point to write a kind of a facsimile to The Thrill Is Gone. He wrote Almost Blue, and the comparison between the two songs, for anyone who knows The Thrill Is Gone, will be obvious. Chet Baker at that time was not learning many new songs at all. That was not on his mind. And yet Elvis Costello presented him with this song, and it really captured Chet Baker, and he played it until the very end of his life, and sang it, of course.
Oh, here it is. Thank you again.
Thank you, Terry.
Almost blue, almost doing things we used to do. There's a girl here and she's almost you, almost. All the things that you promised with your eyes I see in hers too. Now your eyes are red from crying. Oh, rose blue. Flirting with this disaster became me. It named me as a fool.